In this Friday edition, we share excerpts from a virtual panel discussion topic, California's Hidden History of Indian Slavery. The panel includes attorney John Briscoe, tribal judge Abby Abernathy, and the moderator, Professor George Bisharat. This event was co-sponsored by the California Institute for Community Arts and Nature and the San Francisco Historical Society. It took place on Thursday, June 30th, 2022. George Bisharat.
Well, thank you so much and good evening, everybody. It's really a treat to be here with my two friends, John Briscoe and Justice Abernathy. I'm looking forward to a fairly open, free-flowing discussion with our two experts. While I may address particular questions to one of them, the other, of course, is always invited to chime in. So we're going to first ask some questions about what was Native California like pre-contact? How did things shift with statehood? What were the legal structures that enabled forced labor of Native peoples here in California? And then what was the impact of the gold rush on the enslavement of Native Californians? I'm going to begin with Justice Abernathy. Would you do what you can to paint a picture for the audience of what Native California was like in the period immediately prior to European contact? And of course, we can talk about what contact really actually meant in concrete terms.
I think it's important to understand, that we had lived here for thousands of years and we had a way of life and a way of approaching the place and each other that was materially disturbed by the invasion by people who did not share the same value system that we had. And specifically, we are people who primarily have a value system of interrelatedness. So we have systems that are responsibility based, and the responsibilities are interlocking. They're interlocking with each other, with the beings who we coexist with, and with the place we coexist with. So we think we're all one big family. And the people who came here had a very different idea and value system. And their practices, when you have different value systems, then the practices that evolve from those value systems are materially different. So their approach to place and to us was much different than our approach to them and place. And that became the discord. And part of what we're trying to do now, a couple hundred years later, is look back on that and say, okay, for thousands of years, we were in this place and we managed it very well. And then these people came a couple of hundred years ago and basically have really made a mess. And we need to come out and help them understand how to live in this place with each other and with us, because our value system will make us all survive. Their value system, frankly, is pushing us all to the brink. And that's, I guess, the primary difference, and how we've related. And I also want to say that I think that many of the people who came here had very similar value systems where they came from, but as they came in and joined the melting pot, they lost their value systems. And they assumed a value system which was based on, I see it, I take it, it's mine. And that really got us into a really bad spot here.
Part of what you're saying, particularly at the end there, is that there was a different mentality, a kind of a frontier mentality that was neither native, nor was it really reflective of the places of origin from which these people came.
I think that, part of, for them, they need to go back in their value system memory to that, because they were encouraged to take, use. It's mine. If I see it, and that's not okay, And it's not going to work, and it hasn't worked. And we're really creating a lot of damage now, And so we have to come back out and go, look, let's try this again. We have to share our ways. They have to look at us. We have to look at them and go, you know, there's a better way of doing this. And interlocking responsibilities is better than I have a right to do whatever I make up as my right.
John Briscoe.
Contact, and I think it helps, it may help our listeners is realize we really have three points of contact. Mm-hmm. Contact means by Europeans. By 1542 is normally spoken of as contact. When Cabrillo, flying under the flag of the King of Spain, landed in San Diego and claimed it all for, claimed all of what we call California, it was then called Alta California, for Spain, so 1542. But Spain did nothing to colonize California until 1769, when they thought the Russians were coming. That's when the mission system began. So, but that's the beginning of the mission system. 21 missions built from San Diego all the way up to San Francisco, which is not San Francisco. It's Yalamu. It was Yalamu for thousands of years. There was a revolution in Mexico in 1821, and the Mexicans overthrew the Spaniards. So now California is nominally under the hegemony of Mexico, but not a whole heck of a lot changed until 1834, when the Mexican government seized virtually all of the lands of the missions from the Catholic Church and began granting those lands into private ownership, 600 massive land grants. So you have 1542 contact, you have 1769 contact, and then you have 1848, when the President of the United States, so by now, the United States of America has stolen fair and square, to quote Desi Hayakawa, California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, virtually all of Arizona, New Mexico, and large chunks of Colorado and Wyoming from Mexico in a, pardon the expression, trumped up war. Formal treaty was signed 9 days after gold was discovered in California. In October of 1848, President Polk, probably speaking from the ellipse, said to the world in his State of the State address, that rumor of discovery of gold in California is actually true. So all you fine, upstanding people, go to California and take it. There are no laws in California. There were no laws governing the public lands, the public water. So that was contact. That was big contact. So thinking in terms of three contacts, I think, is helpful.
Thanks, John. So let me ask you or Justice Avenanti, either of you, how were Native Californians impacted by Spanish and Mexican colonialism? And since we're talking specifically about the history of enslavement of Native Californians, what were the mechanisms for appropriating forced labor in California before statehood?
Abby, you want to start with that?
I think, you know, the missions were the first place that they needed to conscript a workforce, and they created famine, and they created, here's your only source of eating, and you can come here, and basically they were a workforce, and that was a lot of how it happened, and people were enslaved in those areas, and having been attacked and having been trying to survive, that's what happened. They went to the missions and were basically forced labor. I think that's the first step. And at each of these junctures, they were needed to do the work that other people didn't want to do, or there weren't enough people to do, or it's better if you have them do it because we don't have to pay them kind of work. You know, and that's was the model used in California. Mm-hmm. With a workforce.
Right. Let me just also ask, was there regional variation within what we now, you know, today call the state of California? I mean, the missions were only confined in certain geographic areas. How was that impact differential across the state or throughout the state, or was it?
Well, I think you can look at the missions and their placement and kind of figure that out, because as John mentioned, they didn't come north of Sonoma, you know, as missions. And John knows more about that than.
Yeah, that's right. The 21 missions extend from San Diego in the south to Sonoma in the north. There wasn't much colonization other than the missions until Mexico, having confiscated the lands that belonged, so-called, to the Catholic Church, to the Franciscan priests, and then created these land grants. But the land grants were mainly in the same area along the coast. On the coast, the northernmost land grant is just south of Fort Ross. And there are a lot of land grants in the Central Valley, particularly the Sacramento Valley, but not in the Sierras. Think of the Sierras as still being occupied by the indigenous people and not many settlers until the Gold Rush. And the Gold Rush is really impossible for us to comprehend what the Gold Rush was like. I mean, it was the president of the United States saying there's gold in this country that we've just stolen from Mexico, which stole it from the Spanish, which stole it from the native people who had been here for 1,000 years. Go get it. And they came. The world rushed in. The population of San Francisco before the Gold Rush, a census was taken in 1847. The population was fewer than 500 people. By the end of 1849, the population of San Francisco alone was something on the order of 35 or 40 or 45 or maybe even 50,000 people. Nobody knows. That's how fast they came in.
So, again, turning to the specific issue of enslavement. So there had been enslavement of Native Californians under the Spanish and Mexican colonialism. How did things shift with statehood during California's early years, despite the fact that we entered the Union nominally as a free state, not as a slave-owning state?
The 133rd law that the state legislature passed was for the 8 hearings it underwent, called a Bill for the Protection, Punishment, and Government of Indians. It passed, but was given the name Act for the Government and Protection of Indians. I invite anybody to look it up. It's Chapter 133, Statutes of California, 1850, passed April 22, 1850. Look at Section 20. It provides for the enslavement of an Indian or Indians on the petition of any white man to any judge in the state. The Indian, of course, can't go to court, can't oppose this.
I'm curious about a couple of things. So you mentioned that the word punishment was omitted from the final version of this draft law. And I'm curious what you think that signifies, if anything. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I wonder if it doesn't indicate a certain awareness about what the law, what the actual intention of the law was, and a desire not to have that so obvious to people. And I ask this question in particular because it strikes me that law has been the handmaiden of settler colonialism in a variety of different circumstances, in a variety of different places around the world, that its function is to, in a way, sanitize or whitewash the dispossession of Native and Indigenous people. How you see the role of law generally unfolding in this kind of circumstance?
You know, it's difficult because the law is being used to obscure what is being done. And it's still happening today. It's still happening with the Supreme Court, you know, as they rule on Indian law issues and as they make up things out of, from what my position would be, sort of whole cloth. You know, it isn't precedent if you say blah, 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 and then I come back a day later and say blah, blah, blah. Oh, that makes it precedent? No, I made up the first blah, 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 you know, and that's what is happening. And did they know what they were doing? Yes, I think they did. You know, they weren't idiots. They knew the whole issue about slavery. they knew what might happen to them if they were found out. And it was in a time and place where you could do this and it'd be months or years before anybody noticed, because it wouldn't make it back to DC. It wouldn't make it to Congress. And that's basically it, you know. And we did not have the ability or know how to communicate with them and to say, this is what's really going on now. And here's what they were doing, is finding anybody they could find. And if they didn't find them on the streets, and they went to the villages and stole them and got the courts to certify that they needed to be indentured for whatever offense. So it was pretty clear that's what was going on. But they also wanted to protect themselves and their, what they were grasping for and getting, you know. And from somebody like Calhoun, who might say, no, wait, this isn't right. This isn't okay. This is really slavery. This is really indentured servitude. This is really whatever. And they didn't want the truth out there. And so they used their words to make over it. And I think that's pretty clear. You know, and one of the projects I would like to eventually do, you know, we would like to look at all those records of when they did some of those hearings, you know, when the courts did them, and see what they said, and see, you know, how many of us were taken in that, what our family members were, you know, and try to track that back, because they kept records of it.
Right.
On top of it all, they, you know, they made this part of their history, that they indentured these people. And we know how they felt when they would escape and come home. We know what their stories were when they came home.
We're listening to the Friday edition, California's Hidden History of Indian Slavery. We continue on. George Bissellhardt.
How did things shift with statehood? What were, in particular, what were the legal structures or the legal architecture that enabled continued Indian enslavement during California's early years, despite the fact that we entered the Union nominally as a free state, not as a slave-owning state?
Would you like me to take that one, Abby, or do you want to start?
No, I mean, you got the...
First, a couple of points for context. One is, how big did the slavery business get? Now, anybody who knows downtown Los Angeles, think of that massive federal courthouse on an entire city block. Okay? For years, that was the biggest slave market in California, big open air slave market, an entire city block. There were many, many others in the state, but it was the Walmart of slave markets, Indian slave markets in California. Second, the Indian Slavery Act, or the Act for the Protection and Government of Indians, stayed on the books. This is the act that authorized the enslavement of Indians, stayed on the books for 87 years. It was not repealed until 1937. And the repealer is one of these anodyne statements that only the law can make. Instead of saying the horrific act of April 22, 1850, providing for the enslavement of Indians is repealed, it simply reads, Chapter 133 of the Statutes of 1850 is hereby repealed. Boom. Nobody picked it up in the press. Is there anybody attending this lecture, this panel discussion, who learned about this in school, learned about Peter Burnett declaring a war of extermination against the Indian people in the first state of the state address? I don't think California history is taught anymore, but I know when I took it, these things weren't taught. But to your point, George, as near as I can figure out, reading the text of Section 20 of the Act of April 22, 1850, it's Section 20 that provides for the enslavement. It worked like this. You're a white man, okay? That's the only person who would go to court. You went to court, filed a petition to have so-and-so, you know, that young buck, or this is if you did it legally. I mean, there was a lot of just kidnapping, but if you did it legally, you filed a petition and you took it to a justice of the peace or a judge, and it was signed over. I mean, there's no opposition. There can't be. So here's a judicial order authorized by the state of California providing for the enslavement of one or more people. Governor Burnett gives his first State of the State address, get this date, January 6, 1851, 170 years before January 6, 2021. The highlight of his speech were these words. This is the first State of the State address by the first governor. A war of extermination against the Indian peoples will be waged until they are extinct.
So I think it's worth the audience understanding the kind of the mechanics of this law, how it actually worked, because I think, Justice Avenanti, as you've mentioned, it ties into this question of records and history. And my mind, when I hear those things, goes to the question of reparations and current actions that we can take currently to uncover, identify, and then do something about.
I think the truth is really important, and we have our method of the truth is storytelling. So when you obscure the story, then we don't have the truth. Mm-hmm. And that is robbing from us of that. And, you know, that's why we were talking about, boy, we'd really like to do this project so we could find this out. Because we want our ancestors to know that we cared, that we went back and we looked, and that, because we believe we still have a relationship with them. You know, and that this is in their honor to do that. You know, you don't let people be treated like that and then have them disappear from your conscious memory. That's not okay in our world.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's the difference. You have to look at it. And so part of it is seeking the truth, having the historians pulling those records, looking at that, see if we can tell which families. We won't be able to track them all, but we'll have some of them, you know, and be able to say, this is what happened. And also to be able to say, you know, as we come forward and we look at behaviors, and where did we get some of these bad behaviors that we never had before the invasion and the invaders? Some of it may have come from, if you're raised as a slave, you don't really get much parenting or much work on how you live in community the way we do, you know, and that's not an excuse. You still have to face up to it, that it happened, but it is an explanation, and it does change how you move forward. And then it makes you go, I need to look back and I need to look at that. Because I was talking to a group of social workers one day, and they were talking about poor parenting skills. And I said, well, did you ask any of them how many of their grandparents had been indentured slaves? And they said, well, no. And I said, well, maybe you should. Because then you'd figure out how many of them had these lack of parenting skills passed down. I said, not to mention, we're all Yurok women in here. So you tell me exactly how somebody is going to come into your house and take your children, which they preferred because they were younger and they could keep them under control. How is that going to happen? There's only one way, they said. Yes. And I said, exactly. So some of those kids got to watch their mothers get killed.
Yeah.
I said, and that is not something that helps you move forward. Yeah. You know, the whole question of what we do to fix that is different than the whole question of what we do to articulate it. You know, at first for us, I mean, you know, this is somebody who's a paralegal, who's young and who's studying, and that we're having this conversation, not in relationship to this at all, saying, boy, I've always wanted to look at those. I've always wanted to find those records, you know? And I said, well, you know, if we raise the money, we'll try to raise the money to do that. Because we need to do it just to honor, because we never had a time when we didn't have our stories. This is a gap.
Let me ask you both about the gold rush. What was it about the gold rush? Obviously, there was a huge influx of non-Native peoples in a very short period of time. What about that influx and the kind of the economic changes, things so dramatically, and that caused Indians to be slaughtered en masse instead of being enslaved? Of course, they continued to be enslaved, I'm sure, but something happened there that was different. I wonder if you could help us understand it.
Well, maybe I'll take a first stab at this, and then turn it over to Abby. What, you know, who were these 49ers? Who were they? These were men, almost exclusively, who were leaving mothers, wives, children, churches, creditors, the law, to come make an easy fortune. Just a little bit of digging and it's all free. I don't have to get a permit from the federal government. I steal all the water I want. I take all the land I want and I'm going to make gold. And that's a portrait of a typical 49er. But you had really educated people. Serranus Hastings did not attend the law school, but he read law under illustrious lawyers. And, oh, let's look at Ogden Hoffman, who presided over most of the land cases seeking to validate Mexican and Spanish land grants. Ogden Hoffman was from a patrician Eastern family, and he had gone to Harvard Law School. Both were mightily arrogant people. They were learned in the law, and they would have no hesitation telling you they were. Hastings made himself the first dean of the law school that he founded, Hastings Law School. They certainly knew the principle of aboriginal title, which had been announced by the United States Supreme Court in 1823, and then in 1831, and has been reiterated over and over again. They wanted land, not Hoffman himself, but he was in this club. Stanford wanted land. Stanford built the biggest vineyard in the world, Vina Ranch on the Sacramento River, and he did it in contravention of the principle of aboriginal title. As far as I know, I haven't read every one of the 800 land cases. 600 were confirmed. There were a couple hundred blatantly fraudulent, I mean, laughably fraudulent cases. But in every one, it was between a claimant and the United States government. The Indians weren't there. And yet here you have United States Supreme Court precedent. Well, one motivation is, if we ever give those Indians the right to go to court, they just might assert their rights under international law as recognized by the United States Supreme Court. And the easiest way to take care of that is to kill them.
Justice Abinanti?
Why people do evil is a very hard proposition. I mean, we're talking about today, in today's world, why would you create a drug like fentanyl, put it out there, and watch thousands of people die? What in God's name? You're a human being. I'm a human being. I don't understand how this happens, how a human does this. And some things you just have to accept and go, it's not who I am or what I am and why they do it, I don't know. What's necessary today and in those days is for people to stand up for what's right. And there were people who did. We don't hear much about them because the whole thing is obscured. Just like now, there's people who say no to fentanyl. We've got to do something about this. There's people who are standing up. So the real issue is, how do we stand up now, looking back? How do we get the truth out? How do we do this? I mean, the good news is for all of us that we're not gods. We didn't create this. Humans were created by gods, and how they did it, I don't know. And why they act the way they do, I don't know. I know I'm responsible for myself and to try to move past that. But it's the why part of it is really hard for me to understand. I don't know why it happens. All I know is that at some point you have to say no, whatever, that I will not cross that line and model that for other people. Beyond that, I don't know how this happened. Because, I mean, how do you enslave children? How do you mass murder people sleeping in their homes? I don't know how that happens. I don't know what makes that okay for anybody.
We thank the California Institute for Community Arts and Nature and the San Francisco Historical Society for co-sponsoring the California Hidden History of Indian Slavery, a panel discussion. The Friday edition is a production of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. The producer, editor, and engineer has been Joseph Orozco, lead producer. For KIDE, we thank you for listening.